35 years ago this month, since the wreck of the Titanic was discovered 2.5 miles under the North Atlantic. Of course, it's a ship which has a huge impact on maritime history. It has its own impressive museum and Titanic Quarter in Belfast on the site of the old Harland & Wolff shipyard, and its story has spurred many books and countless films. Dan Gordon is a Northern Ireland actor, director and playwright, and he's written extensively about the Titanic and the Harland & Wolff shipyard. I spoke to him earlier today about the Titanic and how it has become the most famous shipwreck in the world.
It is, and it's an extraordinary thing when you think that it's the most famous ship because it sank. I think there's a number of factors that come into play because of that. And one of them is the legend was kind of born because newspapers had just started to print photographs. And even to the extent that Lord Pirrie had the Olympic, which was being built alongside of the Titanic on the dry dock on the great Arrow gantry, painted white so that it could appear in a newspaper. And then they painted it black again, and it was immense. But it appeared in the newspaper. People got to hear about it as it was being built. And then when she sank, Marconi had pioneered the wireless telegraphy, and that meant that the news hit the papers and the newsstands almost immediately. So it was the first kind of global public tragedy on such a scale in the history of the world. So I think that really contributed to the fact that this happened, and that so many ordinary people had perished. And people had relations in Ireland, so you know, and throughout the country. So it really cut into the public psyche.
And when she was built, she was the absolute cutting edge of technology. It would be like today, every computer in the world dying.
Yes, I mean, it again, and the Harland & Wolff shipyard, and I know we'll talk more about that, they were innovative all the way through their whole existence, right up until today. But, you know, they were putting in, there was triple screw propellers. There was, I think there were two sort of steering wheels, if you like, in it. The massive coal boilers, she was over 900 feet long. And the elegance and the luxury was the thing that they were emphasizing. Like the modern planes where they tell you you can have a bath on the plane, you know. Well, you'd have a Turkish bath, or they had a gymnasium, and they had all the latest kind of inventions. They had three lifts. In the ship as well. I mean, think about it. An elevator was an extraordinary thing in a building, but a lift in a ship. So all of those things combined, and the publicity machine was fantastic because it was the way people were traveling. The world was opening up, and transatlantic liners were probably the most glamorous thing that you could possibly imagine.
They had a first-class kennel for first-class dogs.
They did, and a promenade deck where they could be walked. And the fact that there were so many kind of famous people rushing, it was like the Beckhams of the day were rushing to get on this ship because of the maiden voyage, and it was going to be the greatest thing ever. And they wanted to be associated with it. People, I mean, success has many authors, you know, failure has only a few. And that's what they wanted to be. They wanted to be part of it, you know. And also she had a speed of 24 knots, which is very fast for those days. She was a kind of at the top speed, and she would run at 21 knots as a service speed. I mean, when you look at big tankers and things like that, my understanding is they run at about 14 knots because they're trying to save the diesel, the petrol, the fuel, or whatever they're using. So rushing across, being there quickly, the whole thing of crossing the Atlantic faster than anyone else. The Mauritania and the Lusitania were out there, and they wanted to, you know, they were competing. They came along, I think, afterwards, but they were competing with each other. It was like a space race almost, you know. So the glamour was just immense.
There have been several movies made about it. The last one with the Celine Dion soundtrack. It intimates that the captain of the ship was trying to break the speed limit or break the speed record in the crossing,
well,
and that led to the accident.
Well, yes, I mean, there are so many conspiracy theories. It's like the moon landing, you know, did it happen, didn't happen? Was, you know, did they curse the Pope with every one of the 3 million rivers hammered in because of the Protestants? You know, did the boilers, I mean, there's a whole thing about the rivets were inferior, the steel was inferior, the boilers, that there was spontaneous combustion in the stored coal. all of these are theories. I think the bottom line was he was unlucky. I think the captain was kind of ordered or certainly encouraged to get across as quickly as possible. And it was unfortunately that perfect storm of, you know, icebergs were further south than they normally were, and they just happened to clip one. I mean, the guy in the crow's nest didn't have binoculars, and it just all of that came together. And her design, being a lot of people are familiar with the fact that it was compartmentalized, but the compartments didn't go all the way up to the roof of the deck they were on. So when the weight tipped the water, or the water tipped the end over, and several of these had been punctured, it meant that they filled one over the top of the other and the thing went down. But I mean, you know, you can work out all sorts of ideas about it. I think it was unfortunate. It just ripped along the side of an iceberg. They didn't expect it to sink. And then the legend was born because we lost so many people.
She was built in Harland, Wolf. You have your own family history there. But that boatyard, that shipyard itself, was an extraordinary place.
It was. It was a city inside a city. I mean, my family worked there. My father had five brothers and two sisters. All the brothers at some stage worked there. And one of them did 50 years as a joiner, a carpenter. My aunts, their husbands, one of them was a crane driver in the East Yard. And you went in there and you learned a trade. And as I say, at the top, it was 35,000 men. They manufactured their own steel. They made their own electricity. And they made their own steam. There was a power station. They had wood that they stored in water for years to harden it up. They made their own cabinets and furniture. They made their own nails and rivets. It was so labor intensive. And you spent 5 years learning a trade. You maybe spent 2 years as a messenger boy and working in the stores, and then another 5 years learning the trade itself. It was like training to be a doctor. So these guys were extraordinary experts and skilled in very specific areas of trade. But the labor intensity was the problem. You know, if you needed a hole drilled, a guy came along and measured it and marked it. Another guy came along and drilled it, and another guy came along and put a rivet into it. And it was just the Koreans could do it faster and cheaper and with fewer people, you know. So that's what sort of ultimately was the downfall of the place.
That's what happened to shipbuilding right throughout this part of the world. But going back to the time the Titanic was built, those days of Harland and Wolff, they were really good, skilled, highly paid jobs.
Oh, yes, they were. Well, it's certainly the more skilled you were, the better off you would be. If you were a labourer like my grandfather was, you know, you were at the lowest level. But and the long, long hours, 50, 60 hours a week, you know, you were scraping a living. But further up, the more skilled you were, right up to the like of the draftsmen and the drawing offices, which is now an extraordinary hotel, you would do very well. Thank you very much.
The workforce there wasn't exclusively, but it was almost exclusively Protestant.
Yes, it was. I mean, there was a period of time.
And jealously so.
Yeah, it was a period of time and there was certain unrest in the place, you know, and it reflected, it was a microcosm of the rest of the country, you know. It was sectarian at times. I mean, there would be a lot of shipyard men would jealously rebuke that and say that we weren't sectarian. We had, you know, there were Catholic friends worked alongside us. But because of its location, because of its tradition of handing father to son jobs down, if you knew an uncle, if you knew a cousin, if, you know, that it was jobs for the boys to an extent, particularly in the lower echelons of getting labour and work or whatever. But so there was an element. I mean, that's undeniable, but it reflected the country as well. And I always quote the fact that there was 90,000 people worked in the linen industry. 70,000 of them were women, and they were far more exploited than anybody else, I think, in the history of the industries in Northern Ireland, in the north anyway, you know. And there was a lot of stuff made in the shipyard with the materials on the firm's time that never saw a boat that went home to a little house in Belfast. And people had lovely furniture and had lovely doors and had lovely coloured houses. A lot of it was battleship grey during the war. But, I mean, and you can still see a lot of it there in the where the shipyard was, because there's a visitor centre now. And it was built and opened on the 100th anniversary of the sailing and the launching of the Titanic in 2012. And they hold a lot of artefacts, nothing from the seafloor, nothing that was taken off the grave site, if you like. But
okay, was that a deliberate decision by them?
Very deliberate decision by them, yes. And I think that's it's a very sensitive subject, because there's talk now that they're going to go down and try and get the Marconi radio set that was there. But if you go into the visitor centre, there's a glass floor you can stand on, and you can experience what Ballard and Michel saw when they put the rover down and they found the wreckage initially, and then subsequent visits to the site. And you can see shoes, and you can see the bathroom, the captain's cabin, all filled at 2 miles, over 2 miles down. They found it in, it was the 1st of September, I think, in 85. And actually kind of gave, it started a process for the people of Belfast and the shipyard workers of Belfast, because they didn't talk about Titanic. There was a certain sense of guilt, a certain sense of shame. And in I think it was about 97 or something like that, Cameron made the movie. Well, he got 14 Oscar nominations and won 11, and Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio made the staircase that's now on the top floor of the Titanic Visitor Centre famous throughout the world, globally. They made a couple of $1 billion. So that helped Belfast and people to come to terms with, do you know what? She was all right when she left us.
Really? Do you think that there was a sense of, as you mentioned, guilt?
Totally. My family didn't talk about it.
Really?
Other shipyard workers didn't talk about it. No. Yeah. It was a sense of shame in many households, because the thing was a tragedy, that it seemed to be a failure. And as I say, that line, she was all right when she left us, is something that was around all my life, but it was a very much an undercurrent. Now, people are proud, and the fact that you can come and stand in the dock where the Titanic, it was the dry dock, and see the immense size of it, or you can get onto the Nomadic, which was the tender that took the first class passengers from Cork and wherever out to the ship, because it was too big to bring right into the quays. There's a real sense of the place. There's a maritime walk that you can now do around the Titanic attraction, and you can see all of the sites of Belfast along with the key sites for Titanic and other shipyard work that went on. And in the building itself, they've got a new exhibition, which they actually are paying more, because they always did pay tribute to the workers, but you can actually see the tools that they used, everything from the divers' outfits right through to, like, my father's brace and bit for drilling a hole by hand. There were 67 different trades that built Titanic, 67 skilled sets of guys, from painters through to the guys who built the gymnasium or whatever. And that is an immense workforce. 3,000 men, 3 million rivets, 3 years, and 3 funnels, although there was a 4th one stuck on to make her look bigger and better. It didn't actually work, you know. So, I mean, and I'm not a shipyard worker. I'm just an enthusiast. I'm an actor. But my family were in it, and I just got submerged, which is a terrible pun or metaphor, in the whole thing, you know, because it's just so incredible as a story.
And the visitor centre is open throughout all of the COVID crisis.
They have been very clever. I mean, a lot of buildings and people have been very good and very quick to adapt. There's a booking system. They're allowing kids to go free, because it's really people on the island of Ireland who are visiting at the moment. You know, the Japanese and the Chinese and the Americans and all of the European visitors aren't coming in the numbers that they normally come. So that's a great time to visit it. But they have the whole one-way system. They have all the hand sanitizer you can slosh around. They've got the mask if you don't have one. It's a great time to come.
Dan, you mentioned there yourself that you're an actor, but you're underselling yourself a bit, because you're also a director and a playwright. You wrote a play, The Boat Factory, about Harren and Wolff. It made it to Broadway. Tell me about it.
Oh, yeah, well, it was based on my father and his brothers and the experiences that they had. And I wanted to try and kind of unpick this story for younger people of how people, you know, in days gone by had a job for life, and that they would learn a trade and they would become so skilled. But these guys, they were with each other more than they were with their families. You know, there was a sense of camaraderie, a sense of love of these guys amongst each other. That they worked and lived and very often died together. There wasn't a ship built. There were 1,700 ships all built in the shipyard in Harlan and Wolff, and there wasn't a single ship that at least one man didn't die. Well, That is the kind of thing, you know, the numbers of men who died, there's one for every ship. And in fact, there's several for many of them. Even on Titanic, there was a group of workers went with them. And among them, senior management, Andrews, who was the designer, went and died on the ship. But they were lost. They were called the Guarantee Boys. And they were there to guarantee that if anything broke down, they would fix it up and do snagging on the trip. So there was some terrible tragedy, but there was a lot of fun. There was a lot of camaraderie. So it was just to investigate that whole ethos, that workforce of men, and that vast number who would come out of a shipyard in an evening, and particularly on a Friday afternoon, down through D Street. I think it's a road you're not unfamiliar with, over that bridge, and into the city. They were the life's blood of the city, that industry, that Victorian time when all of Belfast really had linen, and we had tobacco, and we had rope works, and we had shipbuilding. And I wanted to talk about it.
And many thanks to actor Dan Gordon for his time today. And his play, The Boat Factory, is about Howard and the Wolf. Look out for it if it comes to the stage again. Ray Bannerman is a Dubliner and a very keen angler. Early in the summer, he came across a really disturbing case of animal cruelty while fishing. I met him in Baldoyle in North County Dublin, where he was preparing for another angling trip, and he told me what he'd found.
We went down to Baltimore fishing primarily for skate on the 24th of July, and it was an excellent day to go fishing.
Tell me, what's a skate for somebody who mightn't know? They're very big fish.
They can live to 50 to 60 years, and the weight of the one we got that day was approximately 160 pounds. It measured wingspan of 63 inches, and obviously we couldn't measure from nose to tail, but because the fish had been mutilated. When we took her on board, we knew that something was obviously wrong, and on a closer inspection, its tail was missing and its nose was missing. And we were rather shocked by this.
A fish of that size, it's a flat fish, it's almost as big as yourself.
They call them barn doors. If an angler catch one, he says he got a barn door because they're that big, you know. They're actually massive. To get one back into the water, we generally, Nick Dent uses what's like a stretcher, and it's lifted on both ends by four anglers, actually, believe it or not, to hoist them back up and put them back into the water.
You're very careful not to damage these fish. They all go back alive.
These fish are grossly endangered, and this fish was mutilated with its nose cut off and its tail cut off, and we couldn't understand why. And
you must have been shocked when you saw that, because it's incredible level of cruelty.
It was quite disturbing, in fact. The sight of that fish with its tail and nose missing, the sight of that fish, it took me a week to get it out of my mind. And in fact, I felt very ashamed to be Irish that day, and that has never happened to me before.
Has that fish any chance of survival?
Oh, the fish, Nick Dent gave it an identity.
Nick Dent is the owner of the fishing boat you're with.
Nick Dent is the skipper of the charter boat that we went out in, the Rooster. And Nick inserted an identifying tag. And that tag, that fish now has a history. The width of the wingspan, the sex, where it was caught, how it was caught, bait was used. All that will be recorded and sent into the Department of Fisheries, so that any future captures will identify and identify that fish and keep a history on it.
So you think it will survive even though it's been mutilated like that?
Well, tests have shown that fish that are caught on rod and line doesn't seem to have too much of an effect on them. These fish get caught again and again, and doesn't seem to have any detrimental effect on them.
I understand. Am I right in saying that skate fishing is relatively new for West Cork, and it's also very successful?
It's highly successful, but it's not relatively new. Anglers have been fishing there for years and years. There's many different charter boats around the Baltimore, West Cork area, and it's Lots of people have a living with, from hotels to bars to charter boat skippers, guest houses, hotels, you name it. People come from all over the world to fish for these giant fish. We actually should give it more recognition than what we do. We're actually blessed to have a pod or a school of these fish in this area. And up in Scotland, in the west coast of Scotland, they actually have some of these fish as well. But they seem to look after them better up there.
Are they protected species in any way?
They're given protection by the Irish Specimen Fish Committee insofar as any fish that will be caught is not weighed on land, is never returned to land, is always measured on board the boat, and they can determine by the wingspan and by the length of the fish to approximately what weight the fish is going to be.
Peter McCartan, I live in Old Bond in Talla, and I'm an addict to the fishing as well. I was on board that day and witnessed what Ray's after telling you there. Maybe I'd just like to add that them skate, like, they're a treasure to Ireland, and we should appreciate them more. They're not found everywhere. That area down there is unique. Like, there's a family of them around that area, between Union Hall and right around to Baltimore, kind of Clonakilty, Cork MacSherry. That catchment area there is where they live. And these guys now have decided to eradicate them, which is breaking the law. There is a fishery law saying that they have to be returned. Even
how did you feel when you found a fish in that state?
I was horrified. That's why we're making an issue of it. We were absolutely gutted to see it. I mean, we treat them with TLC and let them off again.
How do you go about catching a giant skate like that?
We use a whole mackerel for bait, or maybe a coal fish. We use hooks that just kind of sticks in his lip. Doesn't appear to do them any harm.
Is that on the bottom? Are you drifting, or are you anchored?
You're anchored up, and you let the bait down. You just sit back, and you might have another rod fishing for other species while you're waiting on the big one to come along. And you're blessed if they do.
Is there a big hit, or is there just a tug or a pull?
You'll never forget that fight. Savage. They don't go on mad runs like a tuna would or anything like that. But yeah, you know, you have something on the end, all right.
Now, if you don't mind me asking about here, we're out here in Baldoyle. You're digging bait, you're on another fishing trip.
Yeah, we're going off to Cork in the morning. Several species, hopefully, but we need some ragworm, so here we are. It's handy to get a few here.
This area, is that Portmarnock Golf Club over there in Baldoyle? There's shellfish. We're almost ankle deep in them. It's an incredibly mud. Rich area.
Mud, yeah. I don't know, there used to be an awful lot more mussel here as well. This is the last of them now. When we were lads, this whole place was beds and beds of mussels, as far as you could see down the channel there. We got enough ragworm to do us.
For ragworm, you just dig a trench, is that right?
Yeah, and they live in the ground, yeah.
Ragworm have these, they've legs and these little pinchers. Do they actually bite?
They do, yeah. They can if you let them.
Show you, look.
See that piece there?
That one now is about 9 inches long.
Yeah. You see the wait to see now, the pinchers on the front from here. And there's two little torn things there now, and he can bite you with them. It doesn't really hurt that much, but it's like a torn.
Ray, you're out here, you're digging for bait in Baldoyle. It's an incredibly rich-looking place.
Yeah, you have the biodiversity is wonderful there. It's about, I'm digging out here about nearly 50 years, yeah. Primarily we used to catch... used to collect the mussel and shell it, and we used to use that for bait. Today we're digging ragworm. Up the beach further, there's a bed where you can get a lugworm. Across up the top of the shoreline there, you can get some what's called peeler crab. A wonderful diversity.
People obviously pass by, drive by, don't even know this is here. The amount of life at our feet.
Exactly, and... they won't probably wonder what the hell are we doing out here, getting in ankle deep in mud.
And now you know what those people digging up the beach at low water are doing. If we hear more about that case of animal cruelty, we'll bring it to you. 2 weeks ago on the programme, we had an interview with Kenneth Rumble, who was taking part in the solo figure race out of France. After stage two of that race, Ireland's Tom Dolan is doing really well. He's in 11th place overall out of 35 competitors, and Kenneth Rumble is still in there. Now that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme is podcast, it's on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact me or the programme, the email is seascapes@rte.ie. If you're anywhere on or near the water over the next week, stay safe.
And Seascapes is presented and produced by Fergal Keane. Up next, we have a late date with John Kenny.
RTE Radio 1.
These days, we're all looking for healthy, tasty family meals and lots of variety. The good news is that our fishermen continue to bring us the best of the catch, like fresh Irish hake and haddock. There are so many ways to enjoy them. Try delicious Thai curry with hake or mouth-watering Cajun seasoned haddock. For lots of tasty recipes and different meal ideas, visit boardbeer.ie and look out for Irish Hake and Haddock next time you're shopping. Fresh ideas, great meals.
Don't miss our essential guide to the CAO and non-CAO options this Saturday only in the Irish Independent. Brimming with expert advice on the CAO process, grants and everything parents need to know. Plus our ultimate points guide, details of a free exam helpline, a live Q&A blog and education podcast. Exclusively in the Irish Independent. Real stories worth paying for. Imprint or subscribe at independent.ie.
RTE Radio 1.
You know what, Matt? I'm certainly not going to go home and tell my wife that I've decided to find my passion and follow it.
Yes, darling wife, I'm going to go off for a year and grow some bees.
Yeah.
It's not going to go down well.
You see, I know
part
when
of the
you
issue
have
is
alcohol.
That people are drinking it out of a shoe, yeah, but just not, yeah, in pubs. I think that if you apply a bit of cop on here, like, yeah, limit your social contact.
Okay, let's lighten up a little, yeah, bit. Right?
No, Brendan, I like it down here.
Brendan O'Connor, weekends from 11 on RTE Radio 1.
Well, another Friday has come and is nearly gone at this stage. If it was a busy one and you missed out on the day's radio, Carol Moran has all the best bits in Playback Daily from 2 a.m. Taking us there, it's John Kenny on Late Date.
Thank you, Audrey.
Late Date on RTE Radio 1.
It is
into
indeed.
Into the music, into the night.
John Kenny. Till 2 o'clock in the morning, stepping in for Fegna, who, if you were listening earlier, is in for John Creedon this week and the next. So I'm in for a couple of hours tonight till 2 o'clock in the morning. Music to come from Ben Folds, Emma Langford, Flaming Lips, Bobby Womack, Declan McKenna, Massive Attack, all between now and 2 o'clock in the morning. Text line is open, 51551. That's 51551. Or you can Twitter me at John Kenny Media. That's at John Kenny Media. But now, at 1 minute past 11, let's go to the newsroom and join Karen Carthy.
Thanks, John. Good evening from the newsroom. The acting chief medical officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, has warned that the number of COVID-19 cases in Dublin could double over the next fortnight if people do not take immediate action. Dr. Glynn said the 14-day incidence rate for the capital is now 78 per 100,000 of the population, with 1,055 cases over that period. He called on all people to help suppress the virus this weekend by limiting their social contacts, especially in their homes.
The disease is growing at approximately 4% per day in Dublin. Our best estimate is that the R0 is now 1.4, and if nothing were to change, we would expect to see the number of new cases in Dublin double over the next 14 days.
The National Public Health Emergency Team said 211 new cases of COVID-19 were reported today and one additional death relating to the illness was also reported. Meanwhile, legislation has come into force giving An Garda Síochána legal powers to shut pubs and restaurants that do not adhere to public health regulations. The President, Michael D. Higgins, has signed into law the Criminal Justice Enforcement Powers COVID-19 Bill. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin has said his medium-term COVID-19 plan will deliver a new structure for the government to act on advice from public health officials and eliminate what he termed knee-jerk reactions. The plan is to set out a new framework for how the country can live with the coronavirus pandemic over the next 6 months. The Cabinet is to approve the plan next Tuesday. Speaking in Cork, Mr. Martin said the objective of the government's strategy is to protect public health and protect livelihoods.
There's going to be a structure. There's not going to be knee-jerk reactions. NPHET is there to advise, and governments from the very outset of the pandemic, we've accepted a broad thrust of the public health advice. But equally, we will be creating a new oversight group involving stakeholders in government departments to examine that advice, fine-tuning it, and making sure we can communicate it to the public in a structured way.